Good morning, Steelman.
Good morning, Dave.
Oh man, that's a terrific accent. Are you doing some local theater?
Yeah, just auditioning for The Fiddler on the Roof.
Oh, fantastic. So, what role? Are you going to be the actual fiddler or the dad?
The Roof. I'm playing The Roof. It's not a speaking part, but it's my first break.
I think you'll do well.
I've always wanted
Yeah.
a fiddler on me.
I see you got someone here with you.
Hey, yeah, he was so popular we brought him back. Josh is back with us today. Hey, Josh.
Hi, Dave and Steele. How's it going?
Amazing.
Oh, good. How do you feel? People wanted you back. People said, "Let's get that Josh guy in again." But this time, let's ask him some personal questions, is what they said.
No, I feel great. I feel honored. I feel very happy that people weren't so depressed from the apocalypse episode that they actually wanted me back.
Yeah, everybody
We'll
that wrote
see.
in had this last name Harder. I don't know what that means, but they all said we want more of this Josh guy. So somebody out there loves you.
Excellent.
Well, I'm excited today. We have some good stuff we're going to cover. We're going to ask Josh some expert testimony. We're going to talk about some disaster films, and we're going to take some questions. And of course, as always, we have some music to share with you and a little bit of book wisdom. So, guys, it's school year. School has started in Arizona. I don't know if school started in Wisconsin yet. Are you going?
Well, for me, I'm in grad school. My previous semester just ended today, and my next one starts on Monday, but I don't think that's typical for everybody else in Wisconsin.
He's in the endless semester
Yeah.
right now.
Ours starts just after Labor Day at University of Wisconsin-Madison.
First day of school is coming. Do you have your outfits picked out or?
Yeah, I'm gonna. No, I don't, actually. I'll probably put a shirt on.
That's a good
That's how you
move.
know the summer's over. Coming to work in a shirt.
No pants, though.
Yeah,
That's,
forget that. That's for winter.
Summer work, you wear your tank tops, your cutoffs, but now it's back to being serious.
You know, I've seen this phenomenon lately. I get a bunch of friends who have kids who are now school age, and they take these ridiculous photos of their kids on their porch before sending them off to school on the first day. They're like holding a little sign that says like Bailey's first day of school. It looks like they're like mug shots. What's the deal with that? Did your parents do that to you?
And the kids in the pictures, they look all awkward. They're like, "What am I supposed to
Their
do?"
hair is sticking up like a
Yeah.
dork. They've got some new shirt on. I mean, they're not going to want to remember that 20 years from now.
That's why you take the picture.
But that is, I think from my childhood, every year there's about 20 to 30 pictures, and one of them is me and my three siblings standing up against the garage stiffly in brand new school clothes on the first day of school.
Getting ready for an execution.
Yeah, exactly, pretty much. How come there's no like fourth day of school photos or like 17th day of school? It's always the first day
Or the last day.
or the last day of school. There could be a good before and
I
after.
don't. Well, still, you have a unique opportunity. You have a child. You can maybe take a picture of him up against the garage every day of school, just to really chronicle that school year.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I'll change the internet with that. I don't
Yeah.
have a lot of clear memories of my first day of school. My mom was telling me she remembers this more than I do, but my first day of school was we were living in Maine at the time, kindergarten, and she went to go take me to put me on the bus. And she's thinking, oh, it's going to be, imagining in her mind, it's going to be so hard for him to say goodbye. He's going to be crying. I'm going to have to do this. And apparently, we pointed to the bus, and I got on the bus, and I didn't even turn around and wave to say goodbye. She's like following
I'm
it,
out of here.
waving. She's got a tear in her eye, you know, and I just was just happy to go. So,
Oh, bus memories.
seriously, that was a
Anybody
bad.
have bus memories?
Yes.
I have a good bus memory, which I don't know why I thought this was okay, but when I was like in fourth grade, I didn't know what the various swear words were. I'd never heard them except on the bus. So I don't swear now, but the F word, the S word, like those things, I didn't know. So I remember distinctly sitting with my friend and telling like a second grader that he should go home and call his mom a mother effer. And I didn't know it was wrong. It's like, I said, yeah, your mom will like that.
Gay rights. You're trying to encourage gay rights. Yeah.
Was this friend named Oedipus? Yeah, that's amazing. My bus memory, when I was in fourth grade, this is related to my most frightening first day of school as well, but there was in California, they had this gifted and talented education program. I tested in, and so my parents decided they were going to bus me off of the Air Force Base to this special gifted program.
At an Air Force Base?
We were living on an Air Force Base, and the school was in the Rancho Cordova School District nearby.
I thought that's where your gifted and talented place was.
We had to repair airplanes. Yeah. It was basically a government scam to get cheap child slave labor. So I participated in that for a couple years, and then my hand was crushed by a falling engine and went back to normal school. I was no longer as gifted anymore. No, but we had had to ride the bus, and because there was like only six or seven of us leaving the base to go to the school district sent one of the short buses. And as you can imagine, short buses, when they pull up, are the object of a lot of scorn and ridicule. And then on the way home, we would take we would share it with the severely disabled kids. And so we would go, it was like an hour and a half long bus ride because it would leave the school and it would stop at each child's house and like lower down, get the wheelchair off. And then we'd drive to somebody else's house and their mom would come out, oh, how was David today? And there were some noises or whatever. And then they would wheel him off the bus. And so I had to ride the short bus to school for the whole year. That was my bus memory.
My bus memory involves smell, so you can probably guess where this is going to go, because smell is closely connected to memory.
There you go.
So I recall we lived out in the country at the time, so we were one of the first people on the bus and one of the last people. So this was the morning, so my brother and I were on the bus, sitting there, watching all the kids come in, and we're like the fourth or fifth house, and I can't remember her name. Little Susie comes on the bus. She's walking down the little runway, the bus runway, strutting her stuff, and then she looks in our direction, not directly, but kind of just staring off like something horrible is going to happen. Of course, then she spews all down the runway. And when you're a kid, you're watching someone throw up. You usually want to throw up. But that didn't happen to me this time. All I did was I watched the projectiles, and then I saw them on the ground, and I thought, why the hell was she eating orange peels? And I just remember that still to this day.
That's a real good one. Why was she eating orange peels? And that's what set you on the road to becoming a scientist.
Yes.
So let's get into Josh here.
Yeah. Hey,
we're going to get some expert testimony. So Josh, what do you do? What's your deal?
generically, I say I'm a teach and a tech geek. So most of my life has been surrounded by technology, building technology, interacting with it, and interacting with people and technology. And I've taken that passion and extended it into teaching, coming up with better pedagogy through technology when it's appropriate. So I'm currently working on my MS in education and a certificate in instructional design, and having a great time melding the two together. I get a lot of satisfaction when I see people happy with technology, and almost get that superhero feeling when I'm able to kind of solve their problems and they're looking to you like you're, yeah.
I just wanted to make it clear to Josh, a master's degree may be impressive to some people, but I have a doctorate in nursing and Steele is getting a PhD in poetry. Uh-huh. So I just want you to know what level playing field you're on. But let's go ahead and ask him some questions.
Oh, it doesn't count. Okay. Yeah.
Dave's doctorate of nursing is pretty intense. It's tough to compete.
Well, I didn't even tell you the master's is online, so I think it even matters less, actually. So I think I'm just going to leave, actually.
They just send you a bunch of clip art as your diploma.
And actually, I think my instructor is Dr. Clippy.
The guy from Microsoft Word. Here's a tip. Close your computer when you're done.
Don't give away your password.
Love Dr. Clippy. Great teacher. Yeah, I've been working with him for a while. So the question I wanted to ask you, Josh, was you're one of the people that I think of when I have a tech problem that I don't know the answer to, particularly when it's about a device that I've never heard of.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, just call Josh. Josh will know. where's this device love come from? I think you know more about devices and models of phones and smartphones than any human I know. Why
I think
and
it's
how?
Very similar to kind of the addiction to scrapbooking or collecting stamps or it's the technology equivalent of that. There's so many diverse things. Like I'm looking at your audio recorder sitting on the countertop right now. I know that model, that make. I know the next version. I know the previous version. I know some of the specs. And it's that kind of just, that's my hobby. That's
like card collecting.
It's card collecting. It's my Pokemon. That right, I got to catch them all. And it's not even necessarily, given limited economic constraints, I can't buy all these things. I'm also not a YouTube reviewer, so I can't, you know.
Get free ones.
Exactly. So I read about them a lot. That's a large portion of my newsfeed is looking at technology.
Where did that begin? What was the first gadget that you got really into?
So it would have to be when we were kids, my brother and I, living in Boulder City, Nevada. Our very close friends helped us move into our house. Mormon friends, of course, moving.
But, yeah. They're contractually obligated to help people move.
It's what we do. It's what we do.
There's a little bat light that goes up with the moving truck on it.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And the song, too, really helps. You know they're coming then. but so we get all moved in, and we get into elementary school, and this was the dawn of the Apple Macintosh Plus.
Wow.
The old, like, screen that was about 5 inches diagonal, maybe, all black and white. And my parents thought it was really important for my brother and I to have this, so they got a loan from the bank. And, like, back then, getting the computer, the external hard drive, the modem that did a 2400 baud modem that did all the noises and connected to a bulletin board system in Las Vegas, that was all, like, $3,000 back then.
Wow.
And they got it for us, and my brother on it. My brother and I were on it constantly. He was using HyperCard to make animations. I would create animations and do a lot of graphic design when I was a kid. Every time I created an original story, I created from scratch an image for the cover.
Huh.
We loved it. And figuring out how it worked, all it connected, how it communicated over the phone lines, just this. The other thing I attribute to the whole gadget thing is just a general curiosity, and that's where it gets targeted for me. Just wanting to know how things work.
Yeah, that sounds real similar to my path, but with a different machine. But I can identify with that. Was tech part of your childhood, Dave?
I don't have that curiosity as much and wanting to know how things work. I played video games. I'm not someone that's going to take something apart and look into it. So I'm glad that there are people that want to understand, because I just don't care. I'm just like, hey, this is great. My cell phone's on. I can look at ESPN.com right now.
You don't care how magnets work. They just work. So when you were playing video games, what kind of video game player were you? Did you see a hole and think, that's a hole, I have to walk by that? Or did you see a hole and think, well, is there maybe a secret world in there? And you dove in and died like 9 times out of 10. But there was that one time in that one game you jumped in the hole and you like, we're in a whole new world.
I was definitely not that second type of player. You were.
I was that second player. People annoyed the shit out of people when they watched me play video games. They're like, do you have to jump in every freaking hole that you walk by?
You're always looking for you could have written all the walkthroughs for all the secret passages and stuff. Huh?
So how did you play video games, Dave?
Oh, yeah. I just tried to get it done as quickly as possible. Whatever I needed to be done. Whoever needed to be saved, I wanted to get there as soon as possible.
And they were getting anxious, I'm sure. They were like, I have to wait 47 seconds for you, Mario.
That's actually...
Yeah, the princess doesn't want to sit around. She's got things to do.
And Luigi ain't doing crap.
Seriously,
so.
Luigi's good for nothing.
Yeah, come on. That actually is one of my passions in teaching and learning, is how do you teach students to express that curiosity? And because I think that's the biggest part of learning, is getting people to ask why things are the way they are. And it doesn't matter what field of study you're in, it's how do you teach them skills to ask those questions.
Totally.
Yeah.
And I think it's that shift, what you were describing, it's the shift from being like, these learning tasks, the things I have to learn, are extrinsic to me towards intrinsic to me. It's like when I take an interest in the thing that I'm studying or wanting to know, that's when it really clicks and matters for people. Like the stuff that you read, Dave, the stuff that really matters to you that you're still reading now is the stuff that you read because something inside of you wants to know more about it or wants to read it. And I think that's the trick. Like, really skilled teachers, hopefully, can help that process happen for more of their students for whatever subject they're teaching.
My trick is really, it's hard to do this on a large scale level, but at some point you have to get that little kernel from one student and find out what their connection is to the subject matter.
Right.
Yeah. Because then that opens the doors, because you're like, oh, that's the door I have to go through to get this information connected with you. And
it's interesting. You're studying education. I think one major problem I have with a lot of formal education is textbooks seem to be written in such a way to almost just stifle that curiosity. Even as I was studying to become a medical provider, the human body and how to deal with disease, it's actually very interesting. But every book I read about it was just, every line is just saying, this is not interesting. You don't want to know anything about this.
I could just hear the Charlie Brown teacher reading your text back to you in your head.
Yeah, exactly.
I hate textbooks. Absolutely hate them. I think the best experiences are the handcrafted ones from the subject matter experts, because they have an understanding. They've been where you've been before, and the textbook is just about making money.
Right. So, Josh, we were talking about video games, and I know you're also, would you describe yourself as an avid gamer?
I am a huge gamer. In fact, one of the aspects I'm looking at in my master's degree is badging, which has a lot of, well, I wouldn't say it started with video games, but it became popularized with video games, the idea of achievements, little trinkets
you
and trophies that don't necessarily have any inherent value in the game, other than you get to hold up this thing and say, hey, you know, I did this thing that not everybody else did. I'm looking at trying to adapt that into some of the curriculum stuff that I'm working on.
What were the earliest video games that got you hooked on games?
Oh, gosh. So we had an Atari, but that didn't really take off, because it's kind of like in teaching and learning the orders of thinking, kind of Atari was on the lower order level. It was all multiple choice questions, whereas Nintendo started to get into that world of a narrative, and it wasn't a simple yes or no. It was a see what happens, go here and there. And I found that in Legend of Zelda, the first one, games like Final Fantasy on the Super Nintendo in particular.
Yeah.
For
love
the U.S.,
yeah,
Final Fantasy II, where you were compelled and drawn in to take on a role, which I feel like a lot of the effect of education happens when you are pulled into a role that you're unfamiliar with and allowed to see things from an expert's perspective. I think that happens
cool.
a lot in video games as well.
So becoming a blue mage is really important for education. Is that what
very much? That's what I'm saying. Shooting a fireball, totally applicable for education. Yeah.
Do you have experiences in your education where someone has been able to bring you in like that? Have you had very positive experiences?
Yeah, a lot of it for me was in my AP calculus classes. I had professors, I still remember their names today, Mr. Sox. He was able to really not just have you memorize formulas in calculus, but able to apply in the real world and do a little bit of gamification with it.
And Mr. Sox was a puppet, is that right?
Yes. Yeah. It's like my own puppet.
So how do you want to apply that in your, I guess, teaching moving forward? What do you want to do?
So first, I want to clarify that I'm not a teacher, because I don't want to take a paid downgrade. So I just, no. It's that interesting, in Wisconsin, teachers get, we're having a hard time in Wisconsin with teachers right now. So where I see myself is helping and guiding teachers mostly. I do want to be able to teach a few classes here and there, and there's some opportunities coming up, but I really like being able to be behind the scenes and help guide people, because I don't necessarily have all the subject matter expertise in the particular areas. So taking the skills I have with pedagogy and technology and using those to hold up the people that know all those specific areas. Yeah.
I got a burning question for you before we move on. I want to know, what's the deal with the uvula? What's uvula good for?
Yeah, I'm good transition. So I've had chronic sinusitis over the years, and recently I had to have a surgery. And during that surgery, they intubate you. They place the breathing tube down your throat, and they...
Dude, Dave knows all about this. Dave loves intubations.
Huge fan.
You love large objects being shoved down your throat?
No, other people's throats.
Okay. Good, good. It's a hobby.
That's what Larry Craig said. Keep moving along.
Anyways, so I was out for about 2.5-3 hours for the sinus surgery, and during that time, my uvula dried out and was sticking to the breathing tube or something. This is what they think happened, and it just proceeded to keep crushing against different parts of my throat. So I get done with the sinus surgery, and even though my nose and nasal cavity had a Roto-Rooter, essentially, everything kind of grinded out of it. That didn't really hurt because my uvula was kind of coming to a point, turning black, finally white, and then falling off as I was trying to eat. That was the most painful thing I've experienced in a while. And it was great because when the uvula fairy visited me, she left like a tenner under the pillow. So
fair trade. Yeah. Decomposing uvula for $10, you made a killing on eBay.
Totally worth it. Yeah. Jeez.
You gave me a dry heave, which it takes a little bit to give me a dry heave nowadays. Oh,
I knew, Dave, I thought it was my job to make sure we had a gruesome medical story from one of my friends instead of from you this time.
Dave, sometime I want to talk about my visit to Gross Anatomy, watching the anatomy students.
Oh, just recently.
Have you done that as part of your education?
No way. Doctor of Nursing, which actually just means it was mostly done online.
Guys, I have a little bit of uvula update. I did a little research on this because we were wondering, why do we have uvulas?
Yeah.
So I found an article written by a group of Israeli researchers in 1992. It's called The Riddle of the Uvula. And here's what they said. They said, since ancient times, the uvula has been a subject of interesting and contradictory observations. On the one hand, it was regarded as having a functional role in speech and in immunology. But on the other, it was regarded as a potentially hazardous organ, possibly responsible for sudden infant death syndrome. So it's killing babies. Mm-hmm. None of these hypotheses have been proved. In a previous study, they thought that the most important function was connected with muscularis uvula, which could be related to the ability to drink while bending over. Because only mammals that have this, who drink with bending their necks downwards, seem to have it. So they did a bunch of studies, and they studied chimpanzees and humans, and they concluded that the uvula is a highly sophisticated structure, capable of producing a large quantity of fluid saliva that can be excreted in a short time. Both uvula and speech serve to differentiate human beings from animals. So the uvula is what makes us human. You're just a beast now, Josh.
Yes. Well, I forgot to mention, last time I was on the show, there's the uvula-based apocalypse.
Yes. Yeah. Those are classic. Yeah. Very popular. Man uses his uvula, becomes a beast, and then it becomes contagious.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they think it's a marker of human evolution and possibly an accessory organ of speech. So if you start to lose the ability to form coherent sentences, blame it on the uvula surgery.
Mm-hmm. And it's a burden you'll just have to carry going forward, Josh. I'm sorry.
Thank you. I will carry it.
Well, thanks, Josh.
Thank you very much, guys.
We appreciated you having on as the expert for the expert testimony.
Anytime. Yeah, I will gladly come back.
All right, Still. Well, you brought on a nice guest. He seemed like a nice man. Seemed just like a reasonable person. Great job.
Thanks. He's one of my favorites.
So speaking of one of my favorites, Steele, I just saw a fantastic film in the movie theater last week.
Yeah. Tell me about it. What was it called?
It's called San Andreas.
Oh, is it a Catholic? It's a Catholic priest who does penitence and tries to save a poor village.
Yeah, a lot like that, except way better. It's the Rock, Steel, and he
Whoa!
fights an earthquake.
Wow, that's so fitting. Rock versus Earthquake.
Yeah, who do you think wins?
Oh, The
Take a
Rock.
guess.
Come on.
Yes.
If The
So
Rock ever
it's
failed in a movie, that'd be the end of his career. People wouldn't believe in him anymore.
well, people just wouldn't believe the movie. Like, that's the least believable thing I've ever seen. The Rock failing. This is
Yeah,
ridiculous.
it is ridiculous.
But no, it's your classic disaster film. Earthquake takes out most of California. The Rock is the only guy that can pilot the helicopter well enough to save his wife and daughter. And he does. He does. He pilots the helicopter really well. Best helicopter pilot in the world. He also is an excellent pilot of just small aircraft
That's
and is
good.
great at driving boats around, too.
He's versatile. So I thought what
Indeed.
you were going to say, I mean, it's nice that he saves his wife and daughter, but that's kind of a small scale. I was hoping it would be like one of those things where the San Andreas Fault splits, California falls off into the sea, but The Rock with his helicopter grabs it out of the sea and pulls it back and then reattaches it. Like, just like, ah! And then he sticks California back on. He tows it like Jack
Steel,
LaLanne with it in his mouth, swimming.
when he finds his daughter somewhere in San Francisco, in the building of his estranged wife's, I don't even know how to explain it.
No, it seems pretty straightforward.
Yeah, he finds his daughter with his estranged wife in a building that was designed by his estranged wife's boyfriend
Oh, so you know
in San
it's gonna
Francisco.
fall down.
Yeah, the thing's falling down. If there's one villain in the film, it's the estranged boyfriend. When he gets crushed by a shipping container, I think there may have been someone that said yes loudly in the theater.
Nice. Yeah! Get him, shipping container!
But this is just continuing the great history that our American culture has had with disaster films. Have you seen any of these disaster films?
Run through some of them for me and I'll tell you yes or no.
Armageddon,
No. Oh,
Deep
wait,
Impact,
I did see that. Is that Bruce Willis? Which they have to
Bruce.
like blow up an asteroid?
Yeah, it's
Yeah,
going to blow up the Earth.
I saw that when I was like 16 or 17 at a I worked at this after school center for at-risk kids and we showed it to them. So
Yeah.
most of the time I was like trying to keep kids from fighting. So I don't recall it very clearly, but
Fantastic movie. Deep Impact,
definitely not.
the same exact movie as Armageddon, released in the same year, just with Morgan Freeman instead of Bruce Willis.
Okay, that's what I was thinking of with Independence Day last episode. When I was like, oh, there's two movies that came out the same year, the same plot. It wasn't Independence Day. It was Armageddon and Deep Impact. Okay. Which one had
Yeah.
Mark Wahlberg?
I think, unfortunately, neither, still. I
Well, then I
can't
don't
believe
care.
it.
Move on. Next movie.
Yeah. Day After Tomorrow.
I did not see that. Is that about end of human civilization, like a big tidal wave?
Yeah. It's the same exact plot as 2012, which came out, I think, in like 2011.
Was that the one about the end of the Mayan calendar?
Yep. Yeah.
Nice.
John Cusack had to save his whole family from the Mayans.
By holding a boombox up in the air?
Actually, I believe any disaster film's going to have this scene still where the ground behind the person is just crumbling, and either they're running, or they're trying to take off in an airplane, or they're driving a truck, and every single time they just barely make it.
It's
And
so
John
good.
Cusack made it.
And it's like in the monster movies, and the monster's chasing them, and the spaceship flies away, and the monster has them in their mouth briefly, and then they turn on hyperdrive or whatever. It's the same idea.
It's just good drama every single time. Maybe one day someone will fall. But tons of them. Titanic 1, Titanic 2,
Hold on, there was a
Dante's
second
Peak.
Titanic?
Yeah.
You're not serious. There wasn't a second Titanic.
There's a Titanic 2.
But the ship sinks in the first one. How can there be a second one?
Think about it. What's the obvious answer, Steele? Someone builds a new Titanic, Titanic 2.
They're like, okay, man, that sounds great.
They run into the same sort of issues as Titanic 1, unfortunately.
Did you ever see The Poseidon Adventure?
I did not.
Let's get Gene Hackman, Ernest Borgnine. It's a sinking ocean liner. It's like the original Titanic.
See, they've been making these movies for decades, Steelman.
Yeah.
So, why do you think we keep going back to this particular trope? what's so intriguing about the disaster movie where someone's about to fall into the chasm but does not?
It is the triumph of the human spirit, but it's also the same thing that makes the, you know, our To the Limit segment so interesting, where it's like human beings placed in extreme situations. We feel the illusion of danger, but we know they're going to triumph somehow, and it's going to remind us that as human beings, we're really special, that we can figure problems out and survive. It's one of those like self-rewarding or self, I don't know what the word is, but it's like it bolsters and enhances the sense of self, seeing someone like us survive almost certain destruction. That's my feeling.
I think that's right. I think we want to see people overcome. No one's going to see San Andreas if The Rock doesn't save his daughter. It's going to be the worst movie ever. The daughter can't be crushed by the skyscraper of the boyfriend of the estranged wife. It's just terrible. Mm. So we've got earthquakes. Basically, it's earthquakes and meteors. That's what we mostly see. What disasters would you most like to see on film? What would you be interested in?
Oh, well, I don't know. Like, I think the big one that really got me was Twister.
Oh, yeah.
Seeing the tornadoes, because we used to know tornado chasers when we were in Oklahoma. So that one was like real life, you know?
Yeah, it's excellent. I'm not sure what they learned from chasing those tornadoes, but I believe that what they released, like a bunch of balls into the tornado, and they were able to study the inside of the tornado and make it so there'd never be a tornado again.
Yeah, it was an art project, basically. It was like 99 red left balloons or whatever. No, the other one that I think would be cool are volcanoes. Dante's Peak was a classic.
Oh, yeah.
Whenever you get volcano drama, that's good.
And, of course, Volcano, starring Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah.
Again, those came out in the same year as well.
There's something in the water, the zeitgeist.
There's just a feeling. Everybody knows we need volcano movies.
Mm. Oh, I think Blimp Explosions, anything like The Rocketeer, you remember that one?
Oh, excellent. I like avalanches. I'm a big fan of those in film.
Wasn't there a Sylvester Stallone one with it? Oh, maybe that's rock climbing. Cliffhanger.
The cliffhanger. There's an avalanche. Like, if Sylvester Stallone is climbing a snowy mountain, there's going to be an avalanche. And he's probably going to use it to kill people. I think he did. Vin Diesel does that in Triple X as well. Maybe the best disaster film that's ever been put on tape. He parachutes out of like a helicopter, and he has dynamite in both hands. And he's on a snowboard, and so he throws the dynamite behind him, and boom, snowboards down the avalanche.
Wow, that sounds so plausible.
They filmed it in one take, so he nailed it.
If you had to actually survive a real disaster, which star or character would you want to be your sidekick, or would you want to be the sidekick for?
First of all, I'm going to be the sidekick still. I'm not a leading man. And
that's true.
And you know that the question comes down to you automatically know who are the two that I'm choosing between.
Well,
you know?
Clearly you're choosing between Vin Diesel and The Rock.
But here's the thing. If it's some type of action movie that's not a disaster movie, I'm probably going Diesel. But a disaster movie, you want someone with a pure heart.
Huge
probably
muscles.
Probably huge muscles. Pacific Islander descent.
Yep.
And just someone that's going to save you no matter what happens. So you want The Rock in a disaster movie.
Yeah. Good choices. If you had to choose a female character or a female actress that you had to be with through a disaster, who'd get you through it?
Ronda Rousey.
True. I might pick her over The Rock, in fact. So for me, Dave, I was thinking I would want Robert Duvall.
Yeah? Robert Duvall. What kind of disaster do you think you and Robert Duvall could like take control of and lead people out of?
Stampede. Some cattle go on the fritz.
Oh, jeez. Yeah.
Let's say there's like a saloon that was about to collapse. He could get us out of that.
Duvall could handle either of those situations really well. I mean, regardless of age. Like right now, he could still handle it really well.
Let's say there was like a political assassination, and we were both in the Secret Service, and we had to protect the president.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty sure Robert Duvall could get to the bottom of it pretty quick.
What? Do you have a female actress? A female actor?
Excuse me. Who would I want to survive a disaster with? See, this one's kind of fraught, too, because at least I imagine, hey, the possibility of romance after we survive this disaster together in a different way than I would with Robert Duvall.
That's why Ronda Rousey is such an excellent pick.
You'd be the sidekick in both scenarios, really. I'm not sure. I think maybe Tilda Swinton.
Oh, yeah. Would you want her in... She's always in, like, weird makeup. How would you want her to look during this? Like, a 80-year-old woman?
Yeah.
What do you want from her?
I think 85-year-old woman is preferable. I mean, if we're talking about the possibility of romance, the older the better. That's what I always say. Because, you know, they're less likely to... Mistakes aren't going to happen. And once they're past the stage of fertility, then you just don't have to worry about anything. Yeah, I want a postmenopausal side. I want to be the sidekick to a postmenopausal woman who survives a disaster with me. That's pretty much. See, I should be a Hollywood exec. I don't know why more of those movies aren't getting made.
I've got a postmenopausal friend at work that's moving to Florida.
Nice.
And
she's told
me like 3 or 4 times that she's moving to like this retirement area where it's the number one area in the United States for sexually transmitted infections. So there are other dangers still other than just pregnancy.
Talk
postmenopausal
about
women.
What kind of disaster movie would that be? There's an outbreak of sexually transmitted diseases in like a retirement home. Betty White's the star.
You need to call Hollywood with this one. Now we're talking.
Talking about an amazing disaster film. We'd have to think of some good titles for that.
Chlamydia
Diaper Rash.
Disaster movies. Do you have a greatest disaster movie scene that you've seen that you just think like this is disaster at its best?
Boy, you have to get me started here, Dave, because I'm not thinking of any disaster movies that I've actually seen.
So, I mean, I already described Triple X, but that's not necessarily a disaster movie. I'll give you a scene that I just saw from San Andreas. So, The Rock's estranged wife is on a rooftop in Los Angeles, and The Rock is flying a helicopter at high speeds in to save her. Through the towers, he's got to do some really interesting maneuvering with this helicopter, and the tower just behind the one she's on collapses.
Ooh.
And knocks into her tower.
It's like dominoes.
And gigantic Los Angeles dominoes. The roof starts to collapse. She has to run. Still, we've seen this before. Everything's collapsing behind her. She's climbing up, running. She's probably in high heels even, I'd say. And The Rock gets the helicopter hovering just above her position. He's the only one in the helicopter, mind you.
Yeah.
So he flips the autopilot helicopter switch, which is in every helicopter, and he leaves the controls and has to lower a basket to her. So there's no one flying the chopper.
Well, autopilot is.
Yeah. Well, we all. It's well known that every helicopter has an autopilot. So yeah. So the buildings are falling around, and he lowers the basket down to her. Then suddenly, her building collapses and he can't see if she's on the basket or not. There's just dust in the air and he's pulling up the basket. He sees the top of it and he doesn't see her. But then she calls out and I don't remember his name in the movie, but we'll say, Rock! And he pulls the basket up just a little bit more. She's holding on to it. He gets her in, gets back to the controls just in time because other buildings are falling down. Switches off the autopilot and gets out of there. It's fantastic.
Hey, well, I thought of something while you were describing that heart-rending scene, and it wasn't from a disaster movie, but it involves a helicopter, so that's close enough. I think that's all you're going to get from me. So the classic film, Vietnam War, kind of Apocalypse Now, it features my disaster hero, Robert Duvall, Colonel Kilgore. He's this insane commander of a helicopter troop, and he loves surfing, and he loves surfers. So this combines all of my favorite things. Surfing, Robert Duvall, and a super depressing war movie.
Yes, so, the trifecta.
It's the trifecta. So Robert Duvall recruits the best surfers in the army to come join his helicopter battalion. And when they're bombing cities, it produces a lot of waves and a lot of agitation on the ocean. So he gets his guys out and he makes them surf while they're bombing towns. He's just totally insane. It's a very memorable scene. He loved the smell of napalm in the morning.
The classic speech, yeah. I believe they copied that scene and they spun it off into a whole movie. I believe it's called Surf Nazis Must Die. So check that one out.
I will. Surf Nazis Must Die. Writing it down. It probably won a couple Oscars with a title like that.
It did. It did very well. I think it was produced by Robert Duvall, actually. All right, Steelman. I'm excited we got a nice section of Unchained Melodies. We're talking about school. School's starting. It's here. All the kids in Phoenix metro area, they're already in school. They're going. Wow. So we decided today we'd pick some school-related songs.
What do you want to start us off with, Dave?
Let's go with Common People by Pulp. Uh-huh. This is classic Britpop. Doesn't get better than this. And then she goes to art school.
Jarvis Cocker.
She came from Greece. She has a thirst for knowledge. She studied sculpture at St. Martin's College. That's where I caught her eye. She told me that the debt was loaded. I said, in that case, I'm a woman. Coca-Cola, she said, fine. And then in 30 seconds time, she said, I wanna live like common people. I wanna do whatever common people do. Wanna sleep with common people. I wanna sleep with common people like you. What else could I do? I said, oh, I'll see what I can do. I took her to a supermarket. I don't know why, but I had to start it somewhere. So it started there. I said, pretend you got no money. And she just laughed and said, oh, you're so funny. I said, yeah. I can't see anyone else smiling. Are you sure? You wanna live like common people? You wanna see what? Wanna sleep with common people? You wanna sleep with common people like me?
Great satirical song. Have you heard William Shatner's cover of that?
I have, actually, yeah.
So good. That's great. Good song, school-related song. I got one for you, Dave. And I'm not sure whether I should play the Corgi's version or Beck's version.
Oh, I just go with what's in your heart, man.
Okay, this is Everybody's Gotta Learn Sometime, and this is by the Corgis.
Change your heart. Look around you. Change your heart. It will astound.
That's deep, heartfelt emotion.
That was Wesley Willis on the keyboards there. And the pan pipes. Those are real classic instrumentation on that one.
I felt like I was watching like an after school special, and that's the musical montage was happening. Yeah. As the kid just learned some, it's a tough lesson that he learned.
Yeah, you can't take marijuana in your backpack.
Don't do it. I got a bunch of ones I'm having a hard time picking.
Well, let's just do two more each. Let's do two more each.
Then we're going to go Never Ending Math Equation by Modest Mouse.
I'm the same as the ones when I was 6 years old. And oh my God, I feel so damn old. I don't really feel anything. On the plane, I can see the kind of lights below. And oh my God, I look so alone. I don't really feel anything. Oh my God, I got to move on. Where do you move? Where you moving from? Works on a math equation that never even ever really even is in an end. If
it inspires our creation. We're on the tip of its tongues, and it's saying, well, we ain't sure where you stand. You ain't machines, and you ain't land. And the plants and the animals, they are land. And the plants and the animals eat each other.
It's that, to me, it's something about the creativity of youth. It's really impressive. Like he doesn't write songs like that anymore. It was gathered in just a record of just kind of cast off B-sides, and they just put it out, and it's called Building Nothing Out of Something. And it's one of their best albums of just like cast off songs that he just had such a creative, fertile mind when he's in his 20s, just writing amazing stuff.
Yeah, something about that. Yeah. So here's another one. Guy in his 20s, super creative, inventive song about a school subject. This one's called Chemical Calisthenics by a rap group called Blackalicious.
Good. Can you say it faster? I can do anything. I can do anything. Here we go.
Neutron, proton, mass defect. Lyrical oxidation, your irrelevant mass spectrograph, your electron volt, atomic energy erupting as I get all open on betatrons, gamma rays, thermal cracking, cyclotron, any and every mic you're on, trans uranium, if y'all was uranium, molecule spontaneous combustion, pow! Law of Deva, net proportion, gaining weight, I'm every element around. Lead, gold, tin, iron, platinum, zinc. When I rap your thing, iodine, nitrate, activate. Right, uranium, the only difference is I transmit sound. Balance with some balance, then you add a little talent in. Careful, careful with those ingredients. They can explode and blow up if you drop them and they hit the ground. Let it blow, yo, just let it go, get back. CaOH, 2 lime water, solution of calcium hydroxide. Slotted it, CaO lime will make bleach powder. Galvanic metal beats thump out louder. Dry ice, CO square, refrigerant, NO2 makes you laugh. It's laughing gas used by a dentist. I'm muriatic acid glue, I'm like oil of a troil. The king of chemicals, energy, heat, gas, weight, all your mass. Chemical change, ice point, melt all your raps. Atomic.
One of the smartest rappers out there. That's again in Gift of Gab, Timothy Parker. They're from Sacramento, Dave. My old hometown.
Oh, yeah. That's terrific. You know, if I ever attempt to rap Steelman, it's always in the exact same cadence of a 1980s rapper. So I'm just always impressed that people can do it in a different way than that. So he did. He did.
Yeah. Amazing.
You know, this one doesn't necessarily have to do with school, but it does. Because on every college campus I've ever been on, there's at least one guy that rides a unicycle. And that's just his calling. This song is called Unicycle by a band called Bombadil.
Two wheels is too much for me. And handlebars are too easy. Spin my pedals on just one wheel. Put me on the saddle, I'm out of here. Give me a unicycle, dear. Give me a rubber dusty keel. Give me an edge that I can feel. As I bump up and down the hill. As I bump up and down the hill.
Beautiful, tender little song, Dave. I like that one.
Yeah, it's cute. It makes me think of those guys just out there riding. That's just what they're doing.
All right, here's my last one, Dave. This one I was thinking of. You had a Belle and Sebastian song on the list. This is like a Belle and Sebastian light. It's a band called Camera Obscura.
Yeah, I love them. They're great.
And this is Suspended from Class.
It's such a beautiful ride tonight. It's not. Sorry about making a pass. It was subtle, but I think that you grasped the meaning intended. I can be a friend to you, I won't pretend. I'm not interested in breaking your heart. It's not love, no, it's nothing like that. I'll leave that
That's going to be one of my new go-to sayings. I don't know my elbow from my ass.
It sounds great. I think it'll work well for you. That's just an adorable group. Well, Steele,
so there you
we're
go,
coming
people.
To the end.
Yeah, they're all ready to go back to school now with these songs we just laid on them.
Yeah, you listen to those 6 tracks on the way to school. I think you're going to have a great day.
I think so, too.
So I think you're going to share a book wisdom or poetry, or maybe are you going to rap for us today? I'm not sure which one.
I was thinking about it. I only have one cadence, so I'll do my best. But this is a poem. It's an important poem in English history, I would say. This is by the great poet Roger Waters, and it's called Another Brick in the Wall. We don't need no education. We don't need no thought control, no dark sarcasm in the classroom. Teachers, leave them kids alone. Hey, teachers, leave them kids alone. All in all, it's just another brick in the wall. All in all, you're just another brick in the wall. Beautiful poem, and it reminds me actually of another poem that I want to share with you, Dave. This is by the American poet, just recently died. His name's Philip Levine. And the poem, I used to use this on my first day of class when I taught English. It's called M. Degas Teaches Art and Science at Durfee Intermediate School, Detroit, 1942. He made a line on the blackboard, one bold stroke from right to left, diagonally downward, and stood back to ask, looking as always at no one in particular, what have I done? From the back of the room, Freddie shouted, you've broken a piece of chalk. M. Degas did not smile. What have I done? He repeated. The most intellectual students looked down to study their desks, except for Gertrude Bimler, who raised her hand before she spoke. M. Degas, you have created the hypotenuse of an isosceles triangle. Degas mused. Everyone knew that Gertrude could not be incorrect. It is possible, Louis Warchowski added precisely, that you have begun to represent the roof of a barn. I remember that it was exactly 11:20, and I thought at worst this would go on another 40 minutes. It was early April. The snow had all but melted on the playgrounds. The elms and maples bordering the cracked walks shivered in the new winds, and I believed that before I knew it, I'd be swaggering to the candy store for a Milky Way. M. Degas pursed his lips, and the room stilled until the long hand of the clock moved to 21, as though in complicity with Gertrude, who added confidently, you've begun to separate the dark from the dark. I looked back for help, but now the trees bucked and quaked, and I knew this could go on forever.
The hopelessness of the first day of school, it just strikes me. I've got like another 200 days of this.
Isn't that great? I love that poem. I used to use that on the first day of class every time I taught. I said, all right, guys, let's not be Gertrude Bimlers. I promise you I'm not going to be an M. Degas. What makes class worthwhile? How do we make this better?
Sometimes I just feel like it's hopeless. We'll see. I hope my girls enjoy school. We'll see what happens.
Hey, so Dave, is it true that you are never going to have to take another class again as long as you live? You're fully educated now?
Sort of. I have to do continuing medical education credits, Steele.
Now, you don't have to. You get to.
Oh, yeah. It's a beautiful opportunity. But I will never again, yes, be graded on my performance by
a robot.
Of course, nursing is ruled by 50-year-old women. So I will never be graded by a 50-year-old woman again. And it brings me a lot of hope and joy.
Hey, but I tell you what, once we start casting our postmenopausal disaster flick, you probably have a lot of good suggestions for people who could play supporting roles.
I have a lot of villains. A lot of villains that could be in the disaster movie.
Yeah.
But still, when you read Another Brick in the Wall, one of my friends, the doctor at work at the hospital I went to the most, loves Pink Floyd, and he's Peruvian. And he can't carry a tune, So I'd say 9 out of 10 times that I saw him at some point during the day, he's kind of under his breath singing, "Hey, teacher, leave those kids alone."
Nice. That sounds like a doctor I'd want to perform surgery on me.
He's awesome. Yeah, if you're going to get intubated, you want him to do it.
Yeah, so what's if you asked him, what would be the best Pink Floyd record ever made?
I think he really likes The Wall. I think he's probably his top
Dark Side
record.
Of the Moon guy.
No, he likes Dark Side. He loves all Pink Floyd, but The Wall is his thing, especially Another Brick in the Wall.
Part two.
And he likes all three parts. They're all terrific. But I kept trying over like the 3 years that I've known him. I keep trying to make him do the Wizard of Oz thing with the Dark Side of the Moon.
I've done it.
And he's done it. Isn't it terrific?
Yeah, it's kind of, unless you get it. See, I did it back in the day of CD players, and there weren't pause buttons, so you like had to get the VCR lined up, and then like if it got off sync by like even a second or two, everything was just off.
I probably did it like 8 years ago, but it was beautiful. And the best part was you didn't have to finish watching Wizard of Oz after the 45 minutes are up. You just, all right, we're done.
Done. That's all I have to watch. That's ridiculous. Yeah. Got all I needed from that one. What's a joy, Dave.
Yeah, always good. Let's finish it up. I'll see you later, Steele.
All right, sounds great, Dave. Talk to you soon.
Off the chain. It's off the chain.
He says, "Honey, where are your legs?" Because that's why he couldn't see her. She'd lost her legs and she was shorter.
Yeah, it's tragic.